Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The no-nonsense approach to preventative health care has now come to include men's health. And fortunately, there are people willing and able to write and speak directly about men's health issues and problems. Dr. Harvey B. Simon is the author of The Harvard Medical School Guide to Men's Health and the founding editor of the Harvard Men's Health Watch newsletter. His recent book, The Harvard Medical School Guide to Men's Health, discusses a multitude of health issues that are unique to men, and some are common to women as well. I spoke with Dr. Simon by phone from his office in Boston, Massachusetts, and we started our conversation by talking about the difference between men's health needs and those of women.
First of all, we're dealing with some rather stark statistics, Barry. In the United States, at least, all of the 10 leading causes of death are more common in men than in women. American women have a life expectancy that is nearly 80 years on average, whereas American men come in at just a hair over 74 years. So there's a big longevity gap as well. The paradox is that although men get sick more often and die younger, we pay less attention to our health. Men are prone to what I call the ostrich syndrome, often tending to stick the head in the sand and ignore problems rather than face them head up and get the help that can correct things before problems have gone too far.
Do you think that syndrome is cultural to North American or Western men, or is it more genetic, as is perhaps the longevity?
I think it's a combination of the two. Certainly there are biological factors that help explain the longevity gap. One obvious example is that women during their reproductive years have high levels of estrogen, which improves cholesterol profiles, whereas men have testosterone that has the opposite effect. So there's certainly biological differences, and incidentally we see that as early as fetal life when male embryos die at a higher rate than female embryos. But a lot of it is behavioral. And maybe it's testosterone-driven behavior, maybe it's part of the destiny of males, but a lot of it can be modified, and you're exactly right. A lot of it is conditioned by things we read and see. Instead of calling it the ostrich syndrome, maybe I ought to call it the John Wayne syndrome, the macho guy who just grits his teeth and toughs it out and goes on the best he can.
But do you find that macho syndrome in other cultures?
You do. It's present throughout the Western world and even in the developing world. It's a very widespread thing, and it goes back probably to the origins of humanity, males being the hunters and females being the gatherers. Men have always tended to do the riskier, more adventuresome things. Nearly all cultures do seem to share that distinction.
Bringing it home, what are some of the things that men should look at?
One thing is men should make some effort to understand how their bodies work. I think once you know what a wonderful, if intricate, mechanism you have, you tend to take better care of it. Men should learn the elements of care, ranging from a prudent diet to a regular exercise schedule to the appropriate use of aspirin and other supplements, if appropriate, to cautious use of alcohol, so forth and so on. And men should also learn to get regular medical care. It doesn't take a whole lot to get the preventive maintenance that really can do you a lot of good. And also to recognize early signs of trouble, bring them to a doc's attention, and learn how to navigate the healthcare system to get the best results.
I would think that preventative maintenance is probably the starting point, because that one is education and two is attention to detail. What kind of preventative maintenance is appropriate?
Well, you know, most of it is self-care rather than a care that a physician can provide. In our technologically driven society, we tend to think of tests and treatments as the answers to health. And they're darn important. I'm a practicing physician in one of the most high-tech advanced medical communities on planet Earth. But still, I know that the great majority of things that determine outcome are dependent upon good health habits and self-care rather than checkups and tests, as important as those are. So we come down to things like a diet, exercise, supplements, appropriate use of alcohol. In terms of checkups, yes, they are very important. Men should begin regular checkups no later than age 20 and should continue them on a lifelong basis, perhaps every 5 years in their 20s, every 4 years in their 30s, and so on, so that beyond age 50, an annual checkup is a darn good idea. It's an opportunity for men to learn their numbers, blood pressure, cholesterol, if they choose to be screened for prostate cancer above age 50, their PSA numbers. Men should know their weight and waistline and calculate their body mass index so they know if they need to lose weight. And a certain other preventive tests, particularly screening for colon cancer beyond age 50 or earlier if there is a family history or other risk factors, these are other very important things as part of checkups and maintenance in that sense.
Are you suggesting that being screened for prostate cancer is optional when you say if they choose to be screened for it?
It is optional, and this is one of the things that a little different between men's health and women's health. Both genders should be screened for colon cancer. That's of demonstrable benefit and importance. Women have benefited enormously from a simple Pap test for cervical cancer. Women are generally advised to have mammograms, although, frankly, recent studies have diminished the luster of this screening somewhat, although most authorities still think they are a very good idea on a regular basis, certainly beyond age 50, if not beyond age 40. Prostate cancer is a little different because the disease behaves unlike any other malignancy. It's a very, very common disease. In the United States, a man will be diagnosed with prostate cancer once every 3 minutes this year. But although a man's overall lifetime chance of getting prostate cancer is at least 30%, only 10% of men will ever know it, will ever have symptoms of the disease, and only 3% die from prostate cancer. So there, often the disease is very indolent, sometimes even harmless. And men who receive aggressive treatment for indolent prostate cancers may have side effects without benefit. On the other hand, men who have aggressive prostate cancers and don't detect the disease early enough may get into trouble and deprive themselves of the chance for a cure. So it's a real dilemma. We don't have a firm answer yet. Research is ongoing that will give us the answer, but that's going to take, I would say, at least 5 more years. So in the book, I lay out the pros and cons of testing and early diagnosis, and I think the right thing is for a man to consider these things and then decide for himself.
Let's talk about colonoscopy, as long as we're discussing somewhat invasive exams.
Yes. Well, it's certainly important for everybody above 50 to have systematic screening for colon cancer.
And how does that work?
Men and women. Well, there are a number of options. You mentioned colonoscopy. That's the gold standard test. It's the best test for colon cancer. And anybody at high risk, by virtue of having a parent or sibling with colon cancer, by virtue of having inflammatory bowel disease with long-standing inflammation of the colon or certain other risk factors, anybody at high risk should have a colonoscopy on a regular basis. People at moderate to lower than average risk, people who eat right, who exercise, who take multivitamins, who take aspirin or other anti-inflammatories, who don't have a family history of the disease can choose between a colonoscopy, the best test, or a sigmoidoscopy, a similar procedure, but it looks only a third of the way up the colon as opposed to examining the whole colon, or even a very simple test of sending in stool specimens to be tested for microscopic traces of blood on an annual basis. So there are options here, too. People at high risk should choose the most arduous but most accurate test. People at low risk can take a simpler approach or can go whole hog if they want to be absolutely sure they don't have polyps that might someday become malignant.
When you say the most arduous test, what does that entail?
A colonoscopy requires a very vigorous cleansing of the colon. Unless all fecal material is removed, the endoscopist can't get a good look and detect small polyps. So it involves taking powerful laxatives the night before the procedure. You skip breakfast, you come in, and once you arrive at the hospital, things get a little easier. You get some intravenous sedation, so the test itself is usually painless. Because you are sedated, you need somebody to drive you home, and you have to count on losing a day's work. Most of us saw pictures of President Bush jogging at Camp David just hours after his own colonoscopy. I think the average guy who may not be in such good shape really has to count on giving up productive activities for most of the day.
In the course of that examination, if polyps are found, can some be dealt with?
Yes. Ordinarily, they're actually removed through the colonoscope, sent to the pathology lab and examined to see if they're the sort of polyps that might someday become malignant, so-called adenomatous polyps. And if somebody has this variety of polyps, they should have a repeat colonoscopy at a 3 to 5 year period as opposed to a 10-year repeat once every 10 years if the initial colonoscopy is completely clean and there are no other risk factors.
How are the 3 to 5 year or 10-year limits determined?
Well, we have learned that colon cancer is a disease that behaves in a very predictable pattern. The first step in nearly all cases is the development of a polyp, and then over a period of years, a small percentage of polyps may become malignant, starting on the tip of the polyp. So you have the luxury of time in terms of detecting a polyp before it's malignant or even removing it at the very early stages of malignancy when it's highly curable. And this whole sequence of events from polyps to early malignancy takes years. So it's not necessary to have a colonoscopy every year.
Well, Dr. Simon, I want to ask you about reproduction and the reproduction systems in men and some of the problems and some of the issues. But first, I'd like to say that this week on Radio Curious, we're talking with Dr. Harvey B. Simon, who is a physician at the Massachusetts General Hospital and a founding member of the Harvard Cardiovascular Health Center. He's the author of a recent book called The Harvard Medical School Guide to Men's Health. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Dr. Simon, reproductive issues, how do we deal with them in terms of birth control, sexual function, and dysfunction?
Well, there are a lot of issues. Reproduction and sexuality, of course, are not necessarily synonymous. Young men often want to father children and sometimes need help establishing fertility, which is a very specialized field of reproductive medicine. More often, men want to control their fertility and usually have fewer options than women. Often, guys depend on their female partners for birth control, but men have a responsibility in this area, too. Currently, there are only three practical options for men. The first and least effective is a withdrawal before they ejaculate. A much better way is the use of a barrier method, a condom. And men who have completed their families or are quite sure they don't want to father children can choose vasectomy, a office surgical procedure with very few side effects, that is an excellent way to achieve a permanent birth control. Now, at the other end of a life spectrum, as men age, they often develop sexual dysfunction, particularly in the form of impaired ability to attain and maintain erections, erectile dysfunction, also called impotence. We blame this on aging because it's relatively uncommon in young men, but distressingly common in older men, affecting up to a quarter of Americans above age 65. But I don't think it's a product of age itself. Instead, men who don't take good care of themselves develop atherosclerosis, hypertension, high blood pressure, diabetes, and other diseases along the way, which directly affect sexuality. They also acquire the need for a variety of medications that can interfere with the normal sexual response. If medications are to blame, physicians can juggle them. A patient shouldn't try to do it on his own. But working with a physician, one can often find an effective drug that won't have sexual dysfunction as a side effect. And we have a variety of ways of treating erectile dysfunction, the most famous of which is Viagra, the little blue pill that burst on the scene in 1998 and has really revolutionized sexuality for men.
How has Viagra revolutionized sexuality? What do you mean?
Viagra has revolutionized sexuality for men in America in two ways. The first, very important thing, is that it's made men aware that sexual dysfunction is a common problem. It's nothing to be ashamed of or embarrassed about. It's a problem that can be prevented if men take good care of themselves early on in life, and it's a problem that can be treated if men acknowledge the difficulty and discuss it with their physicians. We used to think that erectile dysfunction or impotence was largely a psychological problem. We now know that just the reverse is true. 80 or 85% of the time, there's an organic or physical cause of erectile dysfunction. Sometimes the cause itself can be identified and treated. More often, the symptom, the inability to attain and maintain a good erection, can be treated. And that's the second sort of revolutionary effect of Viagra, because it helps about 70% of men with erectile dysfunction, perhaps 50% of diabetic men, but overall about 70% of men will respond well to the medication. It's not only effective, but it's very safe, with the important exception of men who take nitroglycerin or any other form of nitrate medication.
What happens with them?
Well, unfortunately, they could have an abrupt drop in blood pressure, which could have very serious consequences. So the use of any nitrate medication is an absolute contraindication, a no-no for the use of Viagra. But aside from that, men who have high blood pressure that's under good treatment, men who have had heart attacks in the past, if they don't use nitrates, can use Viagra quite safely. Naturally, it's a prescription drug that should be discussed with a personal physician, not purchased off the internet willy-nilly without an appropriate discussion of its use and how to use it and how to use it safely. Now, men who fail Viagra or who can't use it do have another set of options available. These are, by and large, older treatments that have been overlooked in the Viagra era. But men who can't take or don't respond appropriately to Viagra nowadays often feel the kind of frustration and shame that men with erectile dysfunction used to feel in the pre-Viagra era. They shouldn't give up. They should, in this case, at least see a urologist who can discuss the other options that sound somewhat unpleasant, but really can help a lot of men who need that kind of help.
In your book, you discuss a lot of statistics, and you put people into percentages of categories with certain standards, which makes us believe that you have established this information on studies and, mm-hmm. and different reviews. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, I'm privileged to work at an institution that has been the home of three very productive and important studies of men's health. These are the Harvard Alumni Study, the U.S. Physicians Health Study, and the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study that together have evaluated some 96,000 men over a period of 25 years or so. And these studies have focused largely on things that keep men healthy, such as exercise, such as the use of low-dose aspirin and certain supplements when appropriate, such as a healthful diet. And I was able to delve into this information, which was generated by scientists in our community, colleagues. I didn't do the primary research myself, but used it as the focus, particularly for the first half of the book, which tells men how to keep healthy.
You talk about supplements. What do you recommend?
The only supplement that I recommend for nearly everybody is an ordinary multivitamin that provides three B vitamins, B6, B12, and folic acid, which I hope and believe will, in the long run, reduce the risk of heart attack, stroke, and possibly even Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. We don't have proof of that, but it's a highly likely proposition, and there's no downside to taking a multivitamin. You will also get vitamin D, which we used to produce in our own skins with sun exposure. Now we're asking people with darn good reason to avoid ultraviolet exposure, and an unintended consequence is that many people are vitamin D deficient and can have problems with their bones as a result. So a multivitamin for nearly everyone. Men above 50 or men with diabetes or men with heart disease or other forms of atherosclerosis really can benefit a great deal from low-dose aspirin, as little as a quarter of an adult tablet, 81 milligrams, so-called baby aspirin a day, can do a lot of good. But here we have to individualize because men with uncontrolled high blood pressure, men with ulcers, men with bleeding problems should stay away or should take aspirin only with their doctor's supervision endorsement. Other supplements of particular interest to men, one is selenium, a mineral that has been linked to a reduced risk of prostate cancer. It's not a proven proposition, but it's a hopeful one. I do take selenium. Only time will tell if that's right, and we'll keep an eye on the studies and inform men as we learn about it. On the other hand, I've no longer been recommending antioxidants. Vitamin E has proven ineffective against heart disease, probably ineffective against prostate cancer, and in certain circumstances, men taking particular cholesterol-lowering medications appears to do more harm than good. Beta-carotene, a supplement that we used to recommend, has also fallen by the wayside, clearly does more harm than good in male smokers, and doesn't appear to help non-smokers. And among other scientific studies that have revealed these facts are the Harvard studies, which I use extensively in the book.
Let's talk about baldness. Is that a detrimental condition or more of a psychologically detrimental condition to some men?
It's the latter, Barry. There is a statistical link between baldness and an increased risk of heart disease, and possibly a weak link between baldness and an increased risk of prostate disease. But it's not that the baldness directly causes either of these much more important problems.
It would be the genetic structure.
It may be genetic. It may be testosterone, which is required for baldness. It's necessary but not sufficient. You need both a gene for baldness and testosterone to have male pattern baldness. So there's no direct physical harm from baldness. Correcting baldness doesn't do the body any good, and it's strictly a cosmetic situation, a psychological condition one of personal choice. There are two medications available that have some efficacy in retarding baldness. They won't restore hair for men who have already lost it, but can have some benefit in terms of slowing down hair loss. But they're both expensive. There can occasionally be side effects, and I generally tell men to decide if they want to go the route of cosmetic use of medication or hair transplant surgery.
Well, Dr. Harvey Simon, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, one of my recreational hobbies is music. I love to listen to music, classical music. I find it uplifting and relaxing at the same time. A novel I read a few months back called An Equal Music by Vikram Seth, an author who's better known for his epic book, A Suitable Boy, and also for a wonderful verse book he wrote called The Golden Gate. This novel, An Equal Music, deals with a string quartet and has music as a theme, but also deals with human interactions, with relationships, which are important for health. I think music can be good for health, too. So it's a novel that I particularly enjoyed.
Well, Dr. Harvey Simon, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Harvey B. Simon is the author of The Harvard Medical School Guide to Men's Health. The book he recommends is An Equal Music by Vikram Seth. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious are available for $10 each. I'll give you the address in just a moment. At Radio Curious, we do appreciate your cards, letters, suggestions, and ideas for future programs. And here's the address. Radio Curious, Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. And the email is curious@pacific.net. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Stay curious, be creative, and join us again next week.